Good morning.
Counsel.
May it please the court, Edwin Aralisa, on behalf of the James O'Neill, if I could have 2 minutes, please.
Proceed.
Your Honor, excuse me. Your Honors, I think the main issue that I'd like to address is whether or not Haidee Vargas was a necessary witness in this underlying motion that is still pending in the Superior Court. And I think the answer is no. And as a remedy...
Do we get to reach that issue, really? Because the ruling was, as I understand it, that he would not quash a subpoena if one was issued.
That was the ruling that was one of the rulings that Judge Kessler did make. I mean, Judge Kessler also found that there was not a conflict with calling one of my own employees in my public defense law firm as a witness against my client. So
right, but is the evidentiary issue right? We don't have a motion to admit evidence. We don't have a motion to disqualify the witness, do we? Is it procedurally in front of him?
That's a good question. I would argue it is at this point, given where Judge Kessler made his ruling presumptively. He ordered basically presumptively that he would not entertain a motion to quash a subpoena. And also, the state of Washington never actually sought an interview and never actually ordered or filed a subpoena with Ms. Vargas.
So isn't the best we can do say, if in fact she's interviewed and if in fact they call her as a witness and if in fact she's going to testify, determine if there's a conflict that would allow you to withdraw?
The court, that is one remedy. I don't think that that would solve the underlying problem. If that does happen, I think that realistically we'll be back up to the Court of Appeals either in an interlocutory fashion or we're going to face the same problem, which is whether or not she's a necessary witness for the underlying motion.
Well, is your you say the underlying problem. Is the underlying problem, in your opinion, that the state is doing things that are going to force you to withdraw?
I don't think that the state, that's their intention, but that's the net impact.
So is that the underlying problem that you're...
That's one of them, yes.
Well, what are the other ones?
Well...
I mean, you know, your brief starts out with they shouldn't be able to call her as a witness. That's one question.
That's correct.
Which, you know, looked at in isolation, okay, she probably has some at least peripherally relevant testimony to give. And every person, the law is entitled to everybody's testimony, so why should the state be able to call her as a witness? Okay. If you set that totally aside, the answer to that is yes, the state should be able to call her as a witness. Okay, but it's interlinked with the fact that you and she, that you're her supervisor, okay, and you're Mr. O'Neill's lawyer.
That's correct.
So your second issue is I should be able to withdraw if she gets into the case. And so then that, if you look at that separately, then that has a lot of punch to it, too. I mean, there's a lot of merit to that. I can see that. But, you know, how do you link them together? I mean, do you want us to keep the state away from Ms. Vargas so that you can remain as your client's attorney? Or do you not care? Do you just want to make sure that you do get to withdraw if all that happens?
The first remedy that I am seeking is for the court to find that she is not a necessary witness. Therefore, the state has other options that they can go and seek other witnesses, other evidence.
And where do we get the word necessary witness? Where does that come from?
So the case law that talks about under RPC 3.7, the circumstances where another lawyer can be called, another lawyer from the same law firm can be called as a witness in an underlying case. And
those cases were directly about opposing counsel being called.
Yes. I mean, that's what it appears to be.
And so, because that would actually disqualify opposing counsel. So that's been restricted to where the testimony is necessary and interpreted as not available elsewhere.
Yes, but that...
But she's not representing Mr. Uni.
No, she's not. I am. So that goes, I think, to the second point, which is...
Well, no, but does that mean, do we reach the necessary test... since she would not be disqualified as his attorney by testifying?
I think you do, because it's imputed to the public defense law firm in this case under RPC 3.7.
So she and you are the same as far as that analysis goes, is what you're saying?
Yes, I think so.
The same person?
Yes, under 3.7 I would argue that.
And that's why she has to be necessary, just as you would have to be a necessary witness if the state for some reason wanted to call you as a witness against about procedures at arraignment.
Yes, that's what I would argue. But back to the point, Your Honor, the first remedy I'm asking is for the state to simply find another witness. I think that's a very reasonable aspect that the state could do. Second, because Mr. O'Neill isn't entitled to the right of counsel, but there's certainly a presumption that he should continue with me. I've been representing him for 2 years. We've interviewed the witnesses on the underlying case. We have already argued some of the underlying motion for rearrangement. So disqualification is not something I am seeking as a first remedy. However, if the court believes that Ms. Vargas is a necessary witness or that the state has the right to call her, I absolutely would ask for disqualification because Mr. O'Neill is entitled to conflict-free counsel, especially with this type of case.
Well, getting back to the question of whether the state should be able to call her, and you talk about how other people could give the kind of testimony she's expected to give, and that's, I mean, you talk about that in terms of relevance, but I'm not sure whether the case is framed, allows us to reach relevance, but it seems like there are some issues that are floating around here on the periphery of the questions framed as the brief that really go to the law of ineffective assistance. I mean, I'm just wondering where this is all headed. How are you and the state, in your own separate ways, going to address this issue? Is there a presumption that whatever happens on the Regional Justice Center arraignment calendar represents professional norms? And that's why it's important to find out what really happens there? Because it seems to me that normally when we're trying to figure out what does the law require, we don't look to what is actually happening. I mean, suppose, is she going to get up and say, well, I have 150 clients every morning, and I don't really have time to talk to any of them, and so under our system, it really wouldn't be possible for me to make the kind of judgment that Mr. O'Neill is suggesting I should have made. Is that relevant? How can that be relevant?
I don't.
Why not get somebody who actually knows criminal law and is an expert, in underlying legal concepts to inform the court about, what you're supposed to do as a criminal defense attorney to represent your client in a particular situation, whether there's 100 other people or not?
I guess this goes back.
None of that's in the briefs, I realize, but I mean, that's where my mind instantly goes when I'm thinking about this.
I think that the objective nature of what the standards of arraignment or the standards of practice for in criminal defense attorney at arraignment is what's critical here, not the subjective, practical, cultural issues that happened at the Regional Justice Center on a daily basis for arraignment. So, for example, calling somebody like Professor John Strait, who is a known expert on ineffective assistance of counsel, who has testified and has actually presented declarations in Court of Appeals briefs on this issue, is one example.
Well, I suppose you could call him if you think he's going to give favorable testimony. But I'm just wondering, there's a lot of different kinds of people that could be called. I'm just trying to figure out the relevance of her.
I don't think she is relevant under these particular standards. That's I think, the why I indicated she's not a necessary witness.
Can I ask you to think about a question to address when you get back up?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can Mr. O'Neill waive, assuming there is a conflict under 1.7, a personal conflict, can he waive that conflict? And if he can waive it, then, or consent to it, what impact?
All right, thank you.
And good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Gabriel Jacobs on behalf of the King County Prosecuting Attorney's Office this morning. I want to start by addressing a couple things. There's two main thrusts to the state's position here. The first is that Judge Kessler properly found that there was no ethical conflict under RPC 3.7 in this case. And I think to begin addressing this question, it's first necessary to look at RPC 3.7 in the historical
case. How about if I redirect you to the last question that was asked? I mean, we've got a peculiar problem here. They're asserting there was ineffective assistance, and the question is what happened at the arraignment calendar. You've brought in the attorney who's got the most experience and is supervising in that capacity, as I understand it, at the calendar. As what? A fact witness? As an expert witness?
Not an expert witness, Your Honor, because Ms. Vargas isn't going to be asked to issue an expert opinion.
What can you point to in the record that would confirm that?
What Ms. Vargas, what the state intends to ask Ms. Vargas, and I'd like to ask remind the court that the state hasn't actually had an opportunity to even interview Ms. Vargas, and that's Judge Kessler's order was simply that the state could conduct an interview to assess.
Where is it going, though? What do you want to do with her? I mean, you're marching everybody around here and getting very close to infringing on the right of Mr. O'Neill to his counsel. And so, it seems like you have to have a pretty good reason, and it ought to be in your brief, why her? What's she going to be asked? How many clients do you have on the arraignment calendar? How many hours do you work in the week? What are you going to ask her?
Senator, the question here ultimately will be one of ineffective assistance of counsel. It's an objective, reasonable standard, but ultimately the courts define reasonableness in these situations as reasonableness under prevailing professional norms. In this case, Heidi Vargas or Ms. Vargas.
Well, isn't prevailing professional norms a little bit different than prevailing professional situations? I mean, if somebody has 100 clients, I'm just making this up. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many clients she has, but I assume it's a large volume practice. And so my suspicion is that you're going to put her up there and say, gosh, a person that has 100 clients, there's no way she could have thought carefully about whether it was possible the state might actually charge something more serious than theft if we gave them enough time to think about how they're going to amend the charges. That's a pretty sophisticated thought. But on the other hand, if Mr. O'Neill had a pretty sophisticated lawyer, maybe not even terribly sophisticated, but somebody with enough time to think about it, maybe that would be the professional norm. So that's what I kind of am positing here. And if so, why Haley, or whatever her name is, why not lawyer Jones from a downtown firm that takes the occasional private client and has had many of them over the years?
So it's a question of a few things. First, depth and experience. Ms. Vargas has probably done, arguably, at least as far as the state is aware, more arraignments than any other attorney in King County, and more arraignments, importantly, under similar institutional pressures and conditions.
Pressures and conditions.
Exactly. A private attorney, for example, doesn't see indigent clients, maybe doesn't see in custody clients, might have a much more different caseload.
Well, let's say that she sees, 100 clients a day because there's a lot of pressure down at the RJC, but let's say that there's somebody kind of like her up in the regular downtown King County courthouse, or maybe in Snohomish County where they do a lot of cases too. Why not a person like that who isn't so close to Mr. Aralisa?
So ultimately, Your Honor, the state wanted what we believed was the best witness.
Why is she the best witness?
Doesn't
the fact that she's so close to Mr. Aralisa take away from her superiority as a witness?
It causes another issue to arise.
It causes problems.
But the state's main priority is to call what we believe is the best witness
Why is she the best witness?
Because ultimately she is the standard of practice for arraignment at the Regional Justice Center. She is the prevailing professional norm.
Can you cite a case where an ineffective assistance of counsel standard has been decided, where it's been decided on the basis of the testimony of the person that has, the largest volume of clients and is most similar to the situation that the defendant at issue is in?
I cannot, Your Honor, but the reason is because very few issues of ineffective assistance of counsel are going to rely on these types of issues. For example, the case.
Do any? In other words, is there any that says, okay, we're going to decide what effective assistance of counsel is based on the person who has the largest volume of clients that can talk about handling this kind of stuff?
Oh, every type of ineffective assistance is different. No two are going to be exactly alike. And the case that gets batted about by both counsel and I in our briefs that was Maynard. And I think Maynard is an example for why certain types of ineffectiveness are good for this type of testimony and certain aren't. Arraignment practice is typically something that's very rote, very routine, something that happens in large volumes, especially in certain attorneys like Ms. Vargas. And so there's a lot of types.
Maybe it shouldn't. Isn't that the question? Maybe this is a problem. If arraignment is happening at such a high volume and high speed rate, do we have to accept that? Oftentimes when you have ineffective assistance of counsel, it challenges the system. Powell versus Alabama, should we take the word of the civil attorneys who were called in at the last minute in order to hustle their clients through a trial in 10 days or whatever it was and say, well, this is what you have to do when you're an attorney practicing in the South where nobody cares about assistance of counsel at all and you get called in at the last minute? This is the standard.
Well, it's an interesting point, Your Honor, in that Ms. Vargas, because we don't even know what she's going to say, it may well be that could be a direction this ultimately heads, but Ms. Vargas, She could ultimately not be good for the state. We don't know. Mr. O'Neill, through Mr. Elisa, assumes that we're calling her because
she might not be good. Well, then why don't you call somebody else if you don't even know,
Well, that's that Mr. O'Neill.
It seems to me like what you're trying to do, what you're telling me, tell me if I'm wrong, but you want to get her because she practices in a large volume docket that you, of course, your firm, as the other side, is also familiar with. And you would like to start from the premise that whatever happens at the RGC is good. It represents professional norms, and because she's familiar with them, she can talk about them. How is that not going to put her in the position of being an expert witness that Mr. Aralisa has to confront in a very vigorous and aggressive way, just like I'm confronting you here? Why is that going to be good for their relationship?
Well, Your Honor, the issue is not necessarily, I mean, I understand they have a professional relationship. I believe if you cross-examine someone, especially when they're, Ms. Vargas is not being accused of any deficiencies, he's not at any risk. We're not asking Mr. Arreola nor the state will have to probe aspects of her personal life or embarrassing details. We're asking for rote details of her practice, what she does on a daily basis. She likely won't even have to be asked about any specific cases she's ever handled. These are matters of routine that she handles on a daily basis.
Maybe you don't plan to ask her that, but why wouldn't Mr. Arreola want to ask her about that?
I don't see, it's the state's position that given the nature of Ms. Vargas's testimony the state wishes to seek, that her credibility is simply not going to be an insignificant issue because...
Well, isn't that great that you could say that, that, you know, you don't intend to challenge her credibility and you're not putting in her a vulnerable situation at all. And Mr. Arreola, of course, will have no occasion to question her credibility because he's not going to want to. And, you know, what so what? Mr. O'Neill, you know, that's his client, but... Who cares about him? Because, you know, after all, Mr. Arreola doesn't want to be mean to Ms. Vargas.
I mean, ultimately, Ms. Vargas has zero incentive to falsify testimony to the benefit of the state. The really only risk, the only way she would falsify testimony, and I don't think she would do that because I believe she's a very credible and honest attorney, her incentive would be to falsify it towards the defense, and that's a risk the state is willing to take because the state is willing to accept her answers as they come. But the defense, I think, is wrong that by assuming that she'll be a prejudicial witness. We believe she's the best witness to discuss the arraignment practices at the Regional Justice Center.
Mr. Arreola's argument that for purposes of 3.7b, she and he are the same?
I mean, 3.7b...
And that's why she has to be necessary.
I mean, I don't think that's true because, I mean, the fundamental purpose of 3.7b is the lawyer-witness rule. It's traditionally to prevent jury confusion, to prevent mingling the roles of advocate and witness. And that's what pretty much every case that exists on the subject, almost every case, or at least almost every case cited by the defense, as was pointed out by Your Honor during the previous round of questioning, deals with attempts by one opposing party to call the other opposing party's advocate and then force them to disqualify them. The state's not seeking to call Mr. O'Neill's advocate, nor is it seeking the disqualification of Mr. Arreola.
Well, you say you're not, but if the natural vector of where you're going leads to Mr. Arreola having to get out of the case, how is that, what difference does your intention make?
I don't know, Your Honor. I mean, the state's first priority is to call what it believes is the best witness. The state objected to Mr. Arreola's withdrawal because the state did not want to be seen as interrupting the attorney-client relationship, and that's not our intention. And also at the time, although in hindsight this was not the case, the state did not want to cause the unnecessary delay of having to bring on new counsel. Obviously, the delay ultimately occurred anyway. But obviously, the state's priority is first to call what it believes is the best witness in this matter to provide the trial court with the information needs to decide the motion.
Your explanation of why she's the best witness, that remains that because she is the person that practices at the highest volume and has the most experience with arraignment, and there's nobody else that has anything even close to her anywhere in King County or Snohomish County or Pierce County.
There are people who do other arraignments counties. They don't have the breadth and depth experience of Ms. Vargas. I would also note that Mr. Arreola pointed out that she handles arraignments for a number of other attorneys and so is exposed to a number of other practices. She is exposed to the general standard practice through other attorneys that she staffs their arraignments for.
She is going to testify about the standard practice, but that's just a fact witness. That's not expertise.
The state's going to be asking her to provide facts based on the specific situations that she encounters during her practice. The state is not going to be asking her to render an expert opinion.
But you are going to ask her about the standard of practice.
The state's going to ask her what she does in her own practice, and in argument, the state may present that as the standard based on her volume and her experience dealing with those standards and in dealing with other attorneys at the RJC, but the state will not be asking her to render an expert opinion in the same way that, say, a true expert would.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Your Honors, I'm a public defender by training and experience, and the skill set that's necessary for a trial attorney, a public defender, is different than what I've discovered as being a supervisor for the last year. And I think the reality is that the RPCs have been specifically designed to avoid this situation. As a supervisor, I have to be aware of employment law, HR issues, personnel issues. So while Ms. Vargas and I no doubt will be professional in our working in relationship, the reality is that we shouldn't be placed in this terrible position. But more importantly, Mr. O'Neill shouldn't be second-guessing whether or not I My loyalty is to protect my job as a supervisor, to avoid causing grievances, union contract issues with Ms. Vargas, and so forth. So to answer your question, Judge, I think the Wixom case in Re Wixom talks about personal interests and how this divided loyalty issue is very serious. And I would argue that that's not something that a client can specifically waive, nor should I, as Mr. O'Neill's attorney, ask him to specifically waive the nature of this conflict.
Do you agree with the state that should Ms. Vargas be a witness, and that if you were the attorney, that your cross-examination of her would be in no way aggressive or in any challenge to her credibility or expertise?
No. I mean, this is part of the problem, is I am aware of Ms. Vargas's training, personal background, HR file issues, because I'm the supervisor. If hypothetically this case went to another lawyer in my office, not King County Department of Public Defense, but ACA Division, which is this silo of our office, that attorney would seek the same information from me and say, how do we discredit this witness? How do we discredit the credibility? Because the credibility becomes critical here, and that's ultimately comes to training and experience, not just what happens in the courtroom. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. The next